Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizohan Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
You know, typically on Wednesday night, you know, we focus on practice-related items, and rarely do we really touch on history, Buddhist history. So the last time that I did this was a little over, well, over 2 years ago. So I thought it was a good time to refresh our memory about some history. So tonight's teaching is called 2600 Years of Buddhist History in 26 Minutes. He actually timed it, 32. In its 2600-year history, from the time of the Buddha to the present day, Buddhism has grown from a tiny religious community in northern India into a movement that now spans the globe. It has shaped the development of civilizations in India and Southeast Asia, and has had a major influence on the civilizations of China, Tibet, Korea, and Japan, and today has become a major part of the multi-religious world of Europe and North America. It is a story of the Buddha himself and the story of generations of people who have used the model of the Buddha, Buddha's life, to shape not only their own lives, but the societies in which they live. Since the Buddha's passing, scholars, philosophers, great masters, and spiritual teachers, first in ancient India and later all over Asia, studied, pondered, questioned, debated, and expanded upon his philosophy. Over the past century, thanks to the efforts of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and other renowned Buddhist masters such as Thich Nhat Hanh, Shunryu Suzuki, and Katagiri Roshi. Mid-century American authors, including Alan Watts, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and more recently, authors like Pema Chodron, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, and Joseph Goldstein. Buddhism has become more popular than ever in America. Buddhism began in northern India around 500 years before the birth of Christ. And as we know, the Buddhist tradition gets its name from a man who was known by his followers as the Buddha, the Awakened One. He was born in a princely family in a region of India that now lies in southern Nepal. The Buddha is typically depicted as sitting very serenely in meditation. He is the very picture of tranquility. And it is this image of calm and contemplative human being that has drawn many people to the Buddha for centuries in Asia and here in the United States. And perhaps it may be why you're sitting in this Zendo tonight. It is this image that conveys most explicitly the experience of his awakening. After his awakening, he taught about his experience to others on the roads of northern India. At about the age of 45, he gave his last teaching to his monks and died. But he left a rich spiritual tradition that has withstood the test of time. The teachings that he left are found in the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and the precepts. At the very beginning, as one would expect, his community was quite small. It consisted of the Buddha and an informal band of followers wandering the roads of northern India, visiting from town to town, teaching the Dharma, and gathering a band of disciples and lay followers along the way. It was a pretty diverse community, and eventually it developed into a monastic community. Lay supporters were critical for the monastic community to survive. The monks and nuns could not continue on unless there were a devoted band of generous lay followers to support them. However, these supporters had to follow some of the ethical teachings, or sila. They were basically the five grave precepts of our 16 bodhisattva precepts. So in order to be a lay supporter, it was not enough to just financially support the community. You had to adhere to some of the precepts that the monks and nuns followed as well. That said, as a lay person, you had to be generous to donate what was realistically possible for the sustenance and support of the Sangha. Sangha during the early days really meant the monastic community. Today, the definition of Sangha is much more expansive and typically includes all supporters of a given community. In the early days, we really were talking about monks and nuns who had engaged in an act of renunciation and pursued the monastic life in the same way that the Buddha did. The spiritual path was essentially restricted to people who had made a commitment to live a monastic life. And in the Theravadin tradition today, that is still the case. In addition to lay supporters, nuns were a significant and important part of the early Buddhist community and were an important part of the expansion of Buddhism into Southeast Asia and into the rest of the world. At the time of the Buddha, most of the world's religions were dominated and controlled by men. It was rare for women to be in a role such as a nun in a monastic community. As I mentioned, the early community began as a group of wanderers, but with time evolved into a settled pattern of life, at least during a portion of the year. In northern India, there is a rainy season that arrives during the months of June or July, the monsoons. And it makes the roads, especially in 4th century India, impassable for a group of wandering monks. It was not easy to go out on these muddy roads and really do the kind of wandering that these monks did. So it was important for the monks to find a place where they could settle down during the rainy season. Sometimes they stayed in caves or even at the base of big trees. But eventually, especially as lay supporters grew, it was possible for them to set up regular dwelling places where they could live during the rainy seasons. These originally were temporary places, but as the community became more complex and more sophisticated, these evolved into regular settled monastic communities in which monks lived all year round and lived an organized life of a group of monastics. In its heyday in India, the great bodhisattva or the great Buddhist monasteries were sophisticated and complex centers of learning. Ironically, these monasteries made the Buddhist community vulnerable to persecution, particularly if public support for the monasteries began to wane, or if you had a group of invaders come in who took their job to be the suppression of the practice monasticism, they were extremely vulnerable. That is eventually what happened in India. During the 11th and 12th centuries, there were a series of invasions that swept across India and devastated many of the monastic communities. So one of the ironies of Buddhism and Buddhist history is that Buddhism virtually died out during that time in the land of its origin, due at least in part to the vulnerability of these monastic institutions. And a more contemporary example of this is what happened in Tibet in 1959 after the Chinese invasion. The monks associated with monasteries became the target of brutal abuse, and many of the monasteries were destroyed. Despite these setbacks, Buddhism has spread throughout the world. As the Buddhist monastic tradition developed after the death of the Buddha, it started to become rather inflexible and insular. Buddhist communities started to take on the character of private colleges or think tanks. Rather than seeking ways of teaching and practice that would be useful in everyday life, the monastic sangha had a tendency to devote itself to analyzing points of abstract philosophical doctrine. Analysis followed upon analysis, and the monk scholars began to enjoy analysis for the sake of analysis. In this environment, meditation became rather sterile, mechanical, and less important. And in some places, hardly any zazen at all. The method of interpreting, understanding, and practicing the teachings of the Buddha became quite rigid, with a hard-line attitude that was difficult for lay people to accept as useful in everyday life. Locked into this rigid or conservative attitude, the monastic sangha became less and less interested in fostering any responsibility to society. The monastic sangha had drifted away from taking into account the difficulties of the world outside the monastery. Fortunately, some senior monks recognized that this form of Buddhism had to change, or Buddhism might be headed for extinction. When the Buddha was alive, the Sangha looked to him as their spiritual leader. They embraced his teachings, or Dharma. However, after the Buddha's death, the Buddhist community was left with a problem. One of, well, where do we go from here? It was realized that the Buddhist teachings needed to be formalized so that the Dharma could be carried forward into the future. So the senior monks got together in what is known today as the First Buddhist Council. And they agreed on the Buddhist teachings so there would be consistency in the Dharma moving forward. And this was important since Buddhism started out as an oral tradition. The teachings of the Buddha were not written down for several centuries after his death. As Buddhism spread, monks began to adapt the Buddhist teachings in different ways. As a result, the consistency sought with the First Buddhist Council started to unravel. Within about 100 years after the death of the Buddha, a second Buddhist council was assembled in an attempt to unify a Buddhist community that was evolving and interpreting the Buddhist teachings in different ways, despite what was agreed upon during the First Buddhist Council. In the end, the council failed to resolve key issues, and Buddhism split essentially into two different traditions: the Theravada, or conservative school, and the Mahayana, or liberal school. And today, these are the two major schools of Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia still represents quite deliberately a conservative approach, and it looks back to the example of the Buddha's early monastic community. And I say conservative in nature in that Theravadan monks follow very strict rules for their daily practice. They follow some 227 rules of daily conduct. For example, they eat only one meal per day. They must beg for their food. They're not allowed to wear jewelry, and monks are not allowed to deal with money. These are the monks that you see in Burma, or now Myanmar, Cambodia, and the forest monks of Thailand. You see them early in the morning in their saffron robes making their alms run or begging for food. Here in the United States and California, there is a Theravadan Buddhist monastery of the Thai forest tradition. where the monks make their morning alms run in the city streets of Redwood Valley. That must be quite a sight. In the Theravada tradition, the focus is on the Noble Eightfold Path, whereas in the Mahayana Buddhism, we focus on the Bodhisattva ideal. What this means is that in the Theravada tradition, practitioners are focused on using the Noble Eightfold Path as a means of seeking awakening for themselves. However, in Zen, since we follow the Bodhisattva ideal, there's a much greater emphasis on being a benefit for all beings, not just ourselves. The four great vows and the benefit for all that we will recite tonight makes this pretty clear. That said, the Noble Eightfold Path is the underpinning of Mahayana Buddhism as well. The Mahayana tradition emerged as a reform movement in the Indian Buddhist community that made a radical change in the way people enacted the Buddhist ideal in traditional India. It changed the style and the tone and the content of Buddhist practice in profound ways within only a few hundred years after the lifetime of the Buddha. Eventually, the Mahayana spread to China, Tibet, Japan, Korea, and to Vietnam, and of course it is here in America today. And the two Mahayana Buddhist schools that we are probably most familiar with are Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. The fundamental teaching of Mahayana Buddhism is, as we know, the Bodhisattva ideal. Now, the Bodhisattva ideal is contrasted to that of early Buddhism by distinguishing itself from what's called the Arhat ideal of Theravada Buddhism. Through the Bodhisattva ideal, Buddhism was opened up in a significant way to lay people. It was a statement that lay Buddhist values and the lay Buddhist life is a place where anyone can pursue the fundamental teaching of the Buddha. And as you can become a Bodhisattva, as the Buddha once was, it's going to lead you eventually to enlightenment. And yes, it is also possible to become a Buddha. And here in the Zendo, we acknowledge this fact by bowing to our cushions. This simple act reminds us that future Buddha is about to sit down. In contrast, the Theravadin tradition teaches that there was only one Bodhisattva, the historical Buddha. Becoming a Buddha is therefore not possible. Unable to dedicate themselves to the kind of austere practices required of monastics, lay Buddhists began to focus only on providing support to the monastic Sangha in order to gain merit that would help them to a favorable rebirth. Lay people did not believe they could become a Bodhisattva or a Buddha. Early Mahayana thinkers saw this as a great danger. The Bodhisattva ideal made it possible for people with jobs, family, aging parents, and other life commitments to pursue the Buddhist path just like monks in a monastery. I had mentioned earlier that the lay supporters of the Buddha were required to adhere to the five precepts. The precepts were developed by the Buddha over the course of his lifetime. They evolved from his very first sermon at Deer Park. The five lay precepts were established as an essential part of Buddhist training as guides for lay people to live a good life. The monastic rules, however, were laid down to help monks and nuns live together in harmony, to create the optimum conditions to further their practice within a monastic setting. In the Theravada tradition, the precepts are viewed more as rules of restraint, which monastics follow strictly, whereas in Mahayana Buddhism, the precepts are viewed more as guidelines for living skillfully. When Buddhism was first introduced into Japan around the 6th century, monks still followed the same 227 rules as monastics. But as Buddhism spread in Japan, the rules were reduced to 16 precepts. And this is what is followed today in most monasteries and Zen centers. Buddhism also has been concerned very deeply in political life in Asia. King Ashoka, an emperor who reigned in the 3rd century BC, is a good example. He converted to Buddhism and became a protector of the Buddhist tradition, and established in Buddhist history an ideal that's known as the Dharmaraja, or the righteous king, who is a protector and promoter of the Buddhist tradition. In addition to being a protector and supporter of Buddhism, King Ashoka sent missionaries out to spread the Buddhist teachings in India and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. Ashoka's ideal has been imitated in traditional Buddhist societies in Thailand, Indonesia, China, and Japan. Buddhism became part of the political system. Another figure worth mentioning is King Mongkut of Thailand, who reigned from about 1851 to 1868. And he's probably one of the most interesting examples of the righteous king ideal. And I say interesting because he was a monk for over 25 years before he ascended the throne. So he came to his position as king as a person who was deeply rooted in Buddhist monastic practice. As king, he believed that Thai monastic life needed to be reformed and returned to the pristine model of the Buddha. Aung San Suu Kyi of Myanmar, or Burma back then, is another striking example of the intersection between religious and political values. She was educated at Oxford and soon emerged as the leader of a movement against 26 years of repressive military rule. She was placed under house arrest, even though the movement won a colossal electoral victory in 1990. The military government annulled the results of the election and imprisoned its leaders. She has spent over 20 years of her life under house arrest, including serving time in prison. While under house arrest, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts to promote democracy and human rights in Myanmar. Her political life and vision for the future of Burma is deeply rooted in Buddhist teachings. I just saw an article a few days ago where, after many years of being in house arrest, she was finally allowed to see one visitor. And this was someone from the International Red Cross. And lastly, as a product of the 1960s, I can't think of any one event that brings into focus the intersection of politics and Buddhist values than when Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Quang Duc burned himself alive at a busy intersection of Saigon in 1963. He set himself on fire to protest the strict anti-Buddhist policies of President Diem of South Vietnam in the Vietnam War in general. He was attempting to show that to fight all forms of oppression on equal terms, Buddhism too needed to have its martyrs. An Associated Press photographer captured that scene in Saigon, and the stark black and white image quickly became an iconic visual of the monks of Vietnam in the Vietnam War. President John F. Kennedy said, and I quote, "No news picture in history had generated so much emotion around the world as that one," end of quote. Zen, as we practice it today, was handed down by the Indian monk Bodhidharma when he traveled to China. He defined it, and that definition has stuck. Bodhidharma said that Chan, Zen, is a special transmission outside the scriptures with no dependence on words and letters, a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of awakening or Buddhahood. Those four points have been the foundation of Zen training ever since. Bodhidharma lived during the 5th or 6th century. He is traditionally credited as transmitting Buddhism to China and is regarded as its first Chinese patriarch. And it's estimated that he is the 28th in a lineage from the time or back to the Buddha. While there were many Buddhist monks from India at the time and a lot of Buddhism in China, Bodhidharma, as I mentioned, was the first to introduce a specific teaching that defined Zen. So here's a question. How did Buddhism come to America? Typically, when we think of the history of Buddhism in America, more often than not, we logically go back to the Buddha as a starting point. Then, moving forward in time, the names of the great Zen masters of the 1960s and 70s. However, Buddhism found its way to America over 160 years ago. Because of the strong influence of Zen on the West Coast, I think it's easy to assume that Buddhism first entered the United States through California. But it actually found its way here, some 3,000 miles away, through the East Coast, from France, of all places, not Japan. The most important milestone in the mid-19th century study of Buddhism was that of a Frenchman by the name of Eugene Burnouf in 1844. Burnouf published a book on Mahayana Buddhism that worked its way to America. This book excited a young writer in Concord, Massachusetts, by the name of Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau, along with Ralph Waldo Emerson, were interested in the cultures and religions of the East. The two men were part of a gathering of like-minded people that would meet regularly to discuss religion and philosophy, and the group is known today as the Transcendentalists. The group grew in size along with its interest in Eastern religions. Eventually, a magazine was published in 1840 to meet the interests of the group. The magazine was called The Dial, and Thoreau became the editor in 1844, the same year that Burnouf's book on Mahayana Buddhism was published. As a result of Thoreau's interest in Buddhism, the first article he penned for The Dial was called The Preaching of the Buddha. You wouldn't call it the preaching today, but that's what he called it. Hundreds of people in America were exposed to Buddhism for the first time by this article. Through this group of transcendentalists, Buddhist thought worked its way outward from Massachusetts. So contrary to what most people would probably conclude, Buddhism entered America through New England from France, not through California. So in conclusion, our presence in this Zendo tonight is part of a journey that started with the Buddha, then through Bodhidharma, then Master Dogen, and ultimately with our founder, Shizaku Roshi. In essence, a journey from northern India through Shimong to Cherry Hill. The diversity of the Buddhist tradition should come to us as no surprise. The Buddha himself said that everything is of the nature of impermanence. The evolution of the Buddhist tradition itself exemplifies this fundamental truth. Buddhism will continue to evolve. It will constantly change to meet the times. The core teachings remain relevant today, as they did during the time of the Buddha. These include the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Precepts. These have remained essentially unchanged all these years and will continue to guide Buddhism into the future.